So thanks everyone for taking the time to join us today. This is the seventh in a series of COVID-19 webinars that we're offering on a complimentary basis to the sport tourism industry. My name is Rick Traer. I'm the CEO of Sport Tourism Canada. And this is the first webinar since the launch of our new brand. So we're pretty excited about sharing with the industry, and we're looking forward to sharing a lot of the applications of the new brand to many of the program services that we offer to the industry. A couple of housekeeping factors just to keep everyone reminded. If you could just mute from the audio standpoint, just to make sure we don't have any background noise other than the speakers. And if you've got a question, please feel free to use the chat function. Everyone should be familiar with that now, and we'll make sure that our panelists have an opportunity to answer any questions that you might pose throughout, or in the event that we don't get to them, then we'll post them on the website after session. This is being recorded, so feel free, to visit that section of our website afterwards to review this and any other webinars that we've conducted to date. So it is my great pleasure today. We have an outstanding group of panelists, beginning with Barb McDonald, and many of you know Barb. She's Sport Tourism Canada's communications consultant and has lived through bomb scares, declarations of war, tragedy, and judging scandals, particularly within the sport of skating, in various roles over 20 different sports, 10 countries, and a lot of years. Sylvie Bigra, in addition to being our co-MC at our annual Congress, is also a dynamic facilitator and is a specialist in communications at international sporting events, including leading an entire media relations communications team at several Olympic, Commonwealth, and Pan American Games. So welcome, Sylvie. Martin Richard is the Executive Director of Communications and Brand at the Canadian Paralympic Committee. He's also a veteran of multiple major games. Most recently was integrally in to the communication of the CPC's decision in conjunction with the COC to not send Canadian team to the 2020 Olympic and Paralympic Games as a result of COVID-19. So looking forward to a great session, and now over to you, Barb.
Thanks very much, Rick, and thanks everyone for joining us. It's been fun preparing this and reliving a little bit of history as I did it, and also working with Sylvie and Martin. It's been really a lot of fun. So we've put together we're going to share a little bit of our various experiences and kind of the lessons that we've learned from each of them. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some of our shared experiences. Many of you I know who are on the webinar today are from the sport community. And I know some are from destinations, and some of our hoteliers and variety of other people are on it. But we thought it was important to talk about our shared experiences when our various roles start to overlap. So first of all, we'll talk individually, and then we'll share that. And then we're going to try to make sure that we leave some time for questions at the end. So I get to kick it off. And I wanted to share with you that I was 2 months into my career in public relations at the time. And my boss walked into the office. I was working in one of the school boards in Ottawa at the time. My boss walked into the office and he said, "There's something about a bomb scare at the school next door. Can you just go deal with it? I've got a meeting to go to." And literally, that was my first crisis, and that was the amount of training that I had going into it. And so just to share with you that you can survive things. And it was an actual bomb scare. We had the school was evacuated, the robot was there. And of course, back in the day, all the media had followed, not Twitter at the time, it was the police scanners. And so I walked out, and that was really my first opportunity to interface with the media with a full-scale bomb scare going on out there. In my career with the school board, a little later on, that boss had moved on, and I was now the director of communications for the school board. And I went through a number of different labor strife issues. We had 5 strikes in 2 years, including one of the first full-scale walkouts that had happened. Again, there was not a lot of information on how to deal with these. We kind of had to just deal with it as we went on. We had, some of the students, it was a really lovely sunny day in May, as I recall, which seemed to be the right day for a student walkout. And we got a little bit of notification, and all of a sudden we had 400 students descending on the school board office in protest of some of the things that were going on. I basically faced almost like a mob scene of well-educated, well-heeled parents when the school board decided that it was going to take away 4-year-old kindergarten. And all of a sudden that blew up, we had pickets and mob scenes, and it was the first time in my life I'd ever actually been scared sitting at the back of the board room for that. And another day I went to leave the office, and I was finally getting away on time, and I walked out, and there were about 600 elementary school teachers standing there in silent protest. We had no idea they were coming, and they were having a barbecue, but they were also protesting some of the labor issues. So you just never know when and how a crisis is going to hit you. I happened to be the press chief for the World Figure Skating Championships, which were going on in Washington, D.C., and we had war declared while I was there, and I was having dinner that night. The entire restaurant went silent as George Bush came on the TV and announced that the U.S. was going to war with Iraq. And in true sport event, it's all about us reflection. I looked at my colleague who was from the U.S. Figure Skating Association, and we kind of went, okay, the Asian athletes are in the air. They'll be on their way. I guess we can go ahead with the event. And then also in some of the events that I've worked in, we've had tragic situations. A suspicious death of a coach when I was working at the World Cricket, and also the death of an athlete at the Asian Games. So just wanted to give you an idea of some of the types of crises that I have dealt with over my career. But the two that I'm going to focus on today, one is one that has a medical implication. And I wanted to just share, even though it's a little bit of ancient history, I wanted to share what it was like to go through the largest mass immunization program in Canadian history back in 1991-92, which may be eclipsed if we have to start vaccinating everyone against COVID. And then also, many of you remember the Salt Lake City judging scandal, the judging collusion that was discovered in the pair event in Salt Lake City, which again I got thrown into. So I'm just going to go through Operation Meningo, which for those of you who may not remember the time, it was what they called a cluster outbreak of meningitis at one Ottawa high school, which resulted in 2 deaths in December of 1991. And so with the medical officer of health made the decision that they were going to inoculate all of the students and staff from that school, which was being affected at the time. And then all of a sudden there were additional deaths that came in January. So on January 10th, 1992, the decision was made that they were going to launch a mass vaccination program in 3 days. Everyone from the age of 6 months to 19 years was going to be vaccinated. And you can see from a copy of the Ottawa Citizen that I just posted there, it was quite a traumatic experience. And the kids from the high school that were originally affected were being shunned. They were being bullied if they were wearing a high school jacket. It had really gotten to be a very difficult situation. So the medical officer of health took the charge, and apparently they traced the infection back to a high school dance, which many teenagers had attended. And what was unusual about this situation is that meningitis normally only appears up to about age 5, and this was appearing in teenagers, and it was viral, and they were dying. And so it was a very, very unusual situation that the medical officer of declared this situation. They were outstanding in their leadership of this situation. They placed a high, high priority on communicating with physicians, with the media, and the public. They had 10 nurses devoted to handling the public hotline calls, and their largest was almost 2,500 calls in one day. They also made the decision that the most effective way of delivering this vaccine was going to be through the school system, which is where I came in because we were the largest school system at the time. And so they had a separate line for both physicians and school principals to call in through. And again, we're talking pre a lot of emails, pre-social media. So while the methodology of communicating was different and was accurate to the spirit of the day, a lot of the principles would apply, even though our tools to communicate today would be very differently. They wanted that every medical decision and policy was issued in writing because they wanted to make sure the message was consistent. And so they had their health inspectors hand deliver 1,300 bulletins to all of the physicians in the area. And they did that twice to make sure the accurate information got out. The regional medical officer of health's office, they dealt with 425 media calls in January. And I looked back and we had over 300 just in our own school board. So the media was also a very critical aspect of getting the message out to people. Because the schools became the delivery vehicle for the vaccinations, we had to make sure that parents got the information and understood what was going to be happening to their children. And at the time, we didn't have a system set up to translate. So the community groups were absolutely critical, and we got the information translated very quickly into, I remember it was 8 to 10 languages, and it might have even been a little bit larger. So between January 15th and 18th, they had to actually order in 145,000 meningitis vaccines. They obviously didn't have that in Ottawa, and actually some of it came from the U.S. military stockpile that they had. So between the 15th and the 18th, we had 39,000 high school students vaccinated. And so our role was, we worked with the regional medical officer of health, and we designated a media op school every day because we knew the media wanted to do it. We wanted to destigmatize it. We wanted to make sure people understood exactly what was going on. And so we would have a media person from the medical officer of health on site, and we had one of our media team out there as well. Our team dealt with welcoming the media, introducing them to the principal, any teachers or staff who were there. Then once they went through the door into the gyms where the vaccination program was taking place, that became the domain of the health people. And then the next week we had 36 elementary schools and 12,000 students a day were being vaccinated. So the things, they called it Operation Meningo. The things that I just wanted to highlight that I learned from this was that there's not always a playbook ready, but effective leadership is key. And communications must be part of the management team. Know your legal ramifications. For example, in the COVID crisis, there's no need to release names to the media. So understand what crisis it is, and if you need to get a legal opinion on something, make sure you do it. Honest, transparent communication is critical. And it's also critical to be consistent, because in a situation like this where things are changing, it's fluid, keep your communications consistent and acknowledge those changes as the information evolves. Designate spokespeople and make them available at all times. In this case, it was the medical officers of health, and they aside from commanding the whole leadership team, they were integrally available to the media at all times. And use this to build relationships with the media. You may need them to get a message out for you. So build those relationships. And then when it's all over, review it and evaluate it. I'm talking quickly because I know how much information both Sylvie and Martin have to share. So I'm just going to quickly go through what I call the perfect storm, the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002, the pair event. I was there as the mixed zone supervisor on the media team that was in the venue. I was not with the Canadian team. I was in the venue that that day. And Jamie Salleh and David Pelchi had really been touted as the first opportunity to be the gold medalists. They were the defending world champions, and they were also happened to be highly photogenic. And a lot of play had been in the U.S. media about the fact that this might be the first non-Russian pair team to win the gold medal in 40 years. When the collusion got unveiled and it sort of the French judge broke down in a meeting and said she'd been pressured to put the Russian team ahead of the Canadians, the ISU said, oh, well, we have a meeting in a week's time. We will deal with it then. That wasn't going to cut it. If any of you remember, that just absolutely blew up. And also the ISU had not, the International Skating Union, pardon me, I should identify who that is. The International Skating Union did not have a communications person on site. They had scheduled her to come in the next week, but they did not have someone there to sort things out. This is just a picture from that day, just to give you an idea of the media storm that it was. And you can see, I can't even count the number of cameras at the back. So this was just one that blew up, and it was ongoing. It was not stopping. It was completely overshadowing the games. And so the International Olympic Committee forced the hand of the ISU, and a second gold medal was awarded to the Canadians. A second medal ceremony was held in the venue, and then the games continued on. This is just a little bit of some of the media coverage of the time. What I learned from there is that you have to get ahead of the story early. You have to adapt the roles to suit the situation. My colleague, who was the press chief, had previously been an advisor to the ISU, so she stepped into that role because there was a vacuum and there was no one giving them any kind of assistance whatsoever. Communications must be part of the strategy. And again, honest, transparent communication is critical. And for those of you in the sports world, you may discover that your international federation may not be prepared. And a credible spokesperson is absolutely essential. And so I'm going to go over to Sylvie. Apologize for rushing through that.
Thanks, Barb. And it's great to join you and Martin on the invitation of Sport Tourism Canada to take part in this webinar. Obviously, the three of us have worked at many games together, so it was fun, as you said in your opening remarks, Barb, to work with both of you as in preparing this webinar. What I'd like to do today, really in the few minutes that I'll take, is just share with you some of my personal experiences that I've had at the 24 major games that I've worked at, and I've listed them there. I'm going to share some examples of crises, and then I'm going to finish with what I've learned as far as managing a crisis, mostly in the role of a communications professional. And so, as you can see, you know, issues and crises occur often. So I think every single person on the call who has been at a major event, whether it's sport or otherwise, there has been a crisis. You may have heard about it or not. Sometimes it's just behind the scenes. And if it is a major event internationally, it's exacerbated by the amount of attention that is paid to that by the media. Also, another issue, especially in the sport world, is we're often in another country, and they may have a different legal system, approaches, systems, values, etc. There are often multiple stakeholders involved. And the biggie is the news window right now. It's 24/7. There are so many social media platforms out there that it's spread very, very quickly. So I'll go to the next slide. So basically, these are just examples of some of the crises that can occur at the games. I've been involved in all of these. I won't go through them, list them, you can read them there. But as you can see, there are a number of different types of crises that can occur, and there are probably more. Next. I'm going to refer to some of these, but I'm just giving you some examples. I'm not going to go through them all individually and tell you what happened and what we did, but these are all, I was saying, you know, if I'm there, there's going to be a crisis. So I have a feeling I'm like the person with the little dark cloud over my head. If Sylvie's on the team, there's a crisis. So maybe we'll stop taking her. Anyway, in LA, East Block boycott, Ben Johnson, I was intimately involved in managing the media around that in Seoul. It was huge. It was obviously impactful, not just in Canada, but worldwide. In Barcelona, we had Sylvie Fréchette, who lost her fiance to suicide and obviously lost her gold medal later on in the game. So it was just a tough time for her. Some of you may remember Silken Lahman holding up Benadryl versus Benadryl D in a press conference when she tested positive for taking the wrong Benadryl at Pan Am Games. Nagano, we had a number. We had media saying there was not enough French at the games for the Canadian team. We had a Bloc Québécois MP said that there were too many Canadian flags in the village. Many will remember Ross Rebliati testing positive for marijuana. And then I'm going to be referring to Kelly Guest and his experience at the Manchester Commonwealth Games. So next slide. More. Another one at Manchester that I'll refer to a little later is an athlete held a Quebec flag waving on the podium, which is against the, you know, the rules for all major games. You're representing your country. I'll refer to that in a bit. Obviously, Barbie mentioned the Saleh Pelletier scandal in Salt Lake. Chicken pox, Martin, I believe that was that swimming? Yeah, okay, so obviously that was your fault. So you can handle the whole chicken pox thing. Joanie Rochette, of course, death of her mom at the games that Barb was very intimately involved in. And then my most recent Olympic games, you may remember pictures of floating cows, talking about Zika, the security issues, etc. So next slide. So we have a crisis. Everybody's paying attention. Everyone knows about it. It's all over Twitter, Facebook. You have to respond. You have to act. And there are many stakeholders involved. What do you do? Next slide. Firstly, I always say this. I say, is it my issue? Or is it an issue? And I say this because we sometimes tend to say, oh, I have to do something. I have to issue a news release. I have to have a spokesperson say something. Something just happened. If it's not, if you don't own it, don't own it. And if it's not an issue, it's not an issue. And I like using this example of the athlete with the Quebec flag. Our chef de mission came to me. I was a press chief at the Manchester Commonwealth Games for Canada. She said, Sylvie, do we need to issue a statement on this athlete making doing something that's against the rules of the games? And I said, well, what's our objective of issuing a statement and saying that it was wrong? I said, well, then are we going to create a Quebec versus Canada issue because it was a Quebec flag? Are we going to do a French versus English issue? And if we say it's okay, then we're actually saying, well, you're not allowed to do that. And she said, what do we do? I said, you have a Q&A. You say, and it's very simple. Basically, you say, the rules speak against it. But from time to time, like Katrina Lemay-Doan did in Salt Lake City with her Saskatchewan flag, athletes will get overcome with emotion and their pride for their province. That's it. You know, it was very easy. So identify if it is an issue firstly, and if it's your issue. By your issue, I mean, if something happens in your world of sport, but it has nothing to do with you, you don't need to make a statement. Not everyone has to have a statement on every issue that occurs. So make sure you make that decision. Because if you get involved in an issue that's not yours, you could get caught in perhaps misspeaking or having to clean up something that's not yours. So what do? You gather the facts. What happened? Who's involved? All of that. And you prepare your internal messaging first. Have a tree. At the bottom there, I say, know your EPRP, your Emergency Preparedness Response Plan. And in that, you'll have a communications tree. So make sure everybody who needs to know what has happened knows about it. And then you probably will have some draft messaging and some draft actions set up for them. And then you prepare your public messages. So you dealt internally first and always react quickly and say, what do we know? So what we know at this time is that there has been an accident. We are continuing to gather facts. We do not know if there's a Team Canada member involved. We are looking into that. We will be back to you as soon as we know. So you don't wait to gather the information. You say, what we know is, and we're going to find out, we will keep you informed. As Barb mentioned, do identify your spokespersons and make sure that they are prepared with both the messaging and the Q&A. So next. What have I learned from working in all with all of those crises that I mentioned? Again, I'm going to repeat some of the things I've just said, but this is really a summary of what I've learned is who owns the issue. Again, I will reiterate, so many people tend to jump in and say and do, and it's really not their issue. Make sure you identify that. Respond quickly. I've seen cases where, the leadership of a games team has said, well, Sylvie, I'm the press chief and I'm ready to go. I'm ready to, I've got my communications ready. I've got a press conference ready to go. And they say, oh no, we, you know, we want to talk to this doctor and we want to talk to this lawyer. And then I always say, we can say what we know at this time and come back later with more. What happens when you don't respond quickly, and I'm sure that Martin will refer to this, and Barb, you already have, is somebody else will take control of the story. And that's the, if you lose control of the story, it becomes a bigger issue than it maybe had been in the first place. The Silken Laman example of Benadryl versus Benadryl D was very simple. She made a mistake. She was told she could take Benadryl. She took the one with decongestant. The decongestant was banned. And so it was really important that we get out very quickly and say, it's an error. Shared responsibility. The physician maybe should have said, I want to see the box. Silken, as an athlete, needs to know what's going in her body, all of that. But it actually became way bigger, and it hurt the athlete, and it hurt the sport, and it just was not a good situation. Always make sure you communicate to all your partners and stakeholders, and I named a number of those earlier. Make sure you keep your communication simple and straightforward. Don't use too much, just be very straightforward, quick, simple, straightforward, and provide updates. I make a joke about now is not the time to consult your 118-page risk management plan, because I was at a games where we had that and we did have issues and we never consulted it. It's important to know what the risk management plan is, to have an emergency preparedness response plan, but that's not the time. Usually you have to react very quickly. And the last one I want to talk about is important to support the, one last slide, to support the team member. I talked about Kelly Guest, who was a triathlete who tested positive in Manchester 02. It was a contamination of a protein supplement that they found. And unfortunately, it was still wrong and he was disqualified and he was a broken young man. He was devastated. His triathlon career was effectively over because the time of the suspension meant he couldn't qualify for Athens, the next Olympic Games. And so what we did is we actually, we built a bubble around Kelly. Who does he need to have with him? Simon Whitfield was a huge part of that bubble. He ended up winning the gold medal there and he had Kelly's name on the bar of his bike. And so there's a lot of support from the triathlon team around Kelly, but we, as a bigger Commonwealth Games team as well, what we did is just before he went back to Canada, we held a press conference with Kelly speaking. And it was hard for him, but what happened is he told his story. He apologized to his teammates for making that mistake, but his healing started before he left the UK. It started before he came back to Canada. There are many instances where an athlete does something, whether they are deliberately wrong or they make a mistake like Silken, it was an honest mistake and whatnot, where they suffer more than they have to. I'll go to the last slide, Barb. And then these are my last lessons learned. As I mentioned, control the story. I want to talk about using the bridging technique. This is one of the most significant things that I teach when I'm doing media relations training and speaking with spokespersons. This is the biggest, most key technique because it helps you go from the question to what you want to say. Talking about controlling the story and having your messages, sometimes the question has nothing to do with your actual story. So always bridge back to what you want to say. We tell athletes, you don't have to answer a question that is stupid. Sometimes there are stupid questions. You can have a smart answer to a stupid question by bridging. Number 10, if you screw up, admit it. There's nothing wrong. I don't know how many times I see, this has been happening in government, right? I go, just say you're sorry. You're human. You screwed up. It's okay. Say, I did this. It was a mistake. I apologize. It was the wrong thing to do. Here's what I've learned, and here's what I will do to make sure this never happens again. This diffuses crises so quickly because you're being human, you're admitting, and you're saying, I am fixing this. This is what I'm going to do. And then obviously, always make sure you learn from all of this, incorporate it in your future plans. That's it from my end.
Thanks so much, Sylvie. And now we're going to turn it over to Martin.
Thanks, Barb. Thanks, Sylvie. I now actually feel less lonely in my little world of thinking that I'm a lightning rod for crises. Because if you see based on the list, I've also dealt with a variety of crises over the years. Some of them being sport-related, work-related, some of them even being personal. And the one that actually I'm always asked of why you put this on the list being my wedding. So I will clarify. that my wedding is not a crisis, but the actual ceremony, a crisis was surrounded by a crisis. So on the slide, you actually see a picture. For the tourism folks on the call, you will recognize that this is a volcano eruption in Reykjavik. And so I wouldn't say fortunate, I was unfortunate actually, that 5 days before my wedding, which was scheduled to take place in the UK, a volcano erupted of all places and grounded all flights. And we had parties coming from various countries around the world. My wife is Singaporean, so she was flying her family to the UK, and same as myself. And unfortunately, within 24 hours, we had to postpone the wedding and essentially rebook all the travel arrangements and arrangements for the wedding in that short period of time. And I was actually very fortunate to have had dealt with several crises in my work related activities, and witnessed a lot of our very brilliant logistics people at games, and took a play from their playbook, so to speak, in dealing with that. So even my own personal life is surrounded by crises at time, and I've learned a lot from those various experiences. So one of the experience, Barb, if you can go to the next slide, please, that I wanted to share, and Barb and Sylvie shared a lot of what happens on the exterior side, how you respond to a crisis. And the example I wanted to bring was more of what happens back of house. And something that's relatable today is obviously COVID-19 and how this impacted the Olympic and Paralympic Games in Tokyo, but most importantly, how it impacted Team Canada. And the decision that the sport community made around at the time of that particular announcement to not send the Canadian team to the Games if they were to be scheduled as planned in 2020, summer of 2020. So that was the decision. So I'll kind of take you through some of the steps, but on the slide, you actually see a few key timelines to better position yourself. So we obviously know that this the outbreak started late December, at least was that's what we know. In January, obviously, the World Health Organization declared this as an outbreak of significant importance and impact internationally. So all to say that this decision actually did not come overnight. And so we had a bit of time to reflect on this. And I think the key part here, and as you're kind of going into some of the timelines that are relate to the Canadian team and what was happening in Canada with obviously this being declared as an outbreak globally, and then our Canadian government responded with starting to shut down public places, training facilities in terms of our athletes, and that having an impact on our athletes. We actually were monitoring on a daily basis. So in terms of our leadership team at the CPC and the COC as well, we're already monitoring global media. We're monitoring, obviously this evolution. We have a group of expert doctors working on various scenarios of what this could mean for us being in Asia for the games. And we're also listening to our athletes and our community and their impact. And when it became to a point where Canadians were not necessarily having a fair advantage to compete in the summer, with no longer being able to access any sporting facilities and training facilities, this is where the timelines actually, as you'll see, they're much tighter together. 17th of March, the IOC announced that the games were still on, despite this being a global pandemic. And in our case, a lot of the country was shutting down in response to that pandemic. On the 19th of March, the CPC felt that it was important to send an update to the sport community. We were receiving a lot of update from the International Paralympic Committee, the IOC, and we felt that we were at a point where we actually had to bring everyone up to speed on what the issues are. On the 22nd of March, the IOC actually put out a statement saying that they actually did need more time to decide what the faith of Tokyo 2020 was going to be. They said, we need 4 weeks. Next slide, please, Bob. And this is where, very shortly after, the Canadian team, both Olympic and Paralympic, responded with a statement that said, we're not sending athletes this summer if the games continue as planned. Now, how that decision came about, which is highlighted in the steps, obviously this started very early in the morning. So in terms of our organization, we have what we call our issues management team. So it's very similar to a major games process. So if there's a crisis, our leadership teams connect, which is obviously our CEO and the executive directors of various departments. So we met very early in the morning, we addressed the situation, and right after that, we had a briefing call with our counterparts at the COC. And then a decision was being crafted based on the leadership of the organization, and obviously connecting with our board of directors to ensure that that decision or that recommendation was being ratified by our board of directors. So in terms of timing, it was mentioned earlier by both Sylvie and Barb, is that sometimes you have to not react too quickly, but when it is the time to react, you actually have to kick things into gear and make things happen very quickly. That said, we had already developed a scenario on this particular case. So this plan was not crafted in matters of hours. We had a scenario that said, if this escalates, what if we can't send a team to Tokyo? What does that mean? And we had actually rehearsed parts of this, of the outcome as part of the scenario. So we already had a good reflection on this. In terms of us, and I first started by saying this was a sport community decision. Obviously, the voice of the decision was the Canadian Paralympic and Olympic Committee. But this actually did not happen on its own. We consulted, obviously, with our leadership team. And then from there, we ensured that all CEOs and presidents of all the national sport federations in Canada, both Olympic and Paralympic, were consulted on this decision and had input before the final decision was made. We also included our athlete councils on both sides, Olympic and Paralympic, to ensure that obviously this decision was going to impact the athletes. We wanted to make sure that they were part of this decision. And then from there, we drafted obviously our final statement, and that was released in the evening of the 22nd of March. From there, it's kind of like you unleash the bomb, so to speak, because we actually created the issue in this particular scenario. We were the first nation to speak up on that particular case. No other nation had really made a call on what their stance was going to be. And then as time evolved during the next 24 hours or so, you saw countries like New Zealand and whatnot joining the decision to not send teams. But Canada was the first one. And so obviously there was a lot of interest with media to better understand what our rationale. And secondly, the impact of our athletes. That was the core thing. And we needed to ensure that, A, the athletes were aware of this statement before it was released. So we actually released an embargoed release to our sport community. And we gave a heads up to the media and saying, at this particular time, we will announce our position on 2020 games. And so people were expecting it. And so when we released it, the sequencing was manageable. It wasn't, you're getting 1,000 phone calls in a second. So we had already planned this release and media were aware of it. They just didn't know the details and obviously the position that we were taking. And we also planned to ensure that our athletes were made available and that our athletes, the bulk of our athletes through our athlete councils had already received the information. And then from there, the outcome, I would not necessarily say that IOC's decision was based on our statement, but on the 24th of March, the IOC came back and said they will postpone the games until summer of 2021. So in terms of sequencing things did appear like it happened very quickly, but they were well prepared. In terms of lessons learned for us, what's important is when you're dealing with any type of crisis, you need to understand that you're dealing with people first. It always impacts people, and particularly in the world of sport. It impacts your athletes, your coaches, your support team, etc. And sometimes your emotions could become your biggest barrier. In all cases, when it impacts an athlete and we have an emotional connection to that athlete, it could cloud our judgment in the words that we choose, in the focus that we require, and all of that. So it's important to always prepare for that. How am I going to manage my emotions? And sometimes it's, I need to take a deep breath. Sometimes it's, I need to take a walk. Sometimes I need to shut out my emotions for now. And it varies between individuals. But you always need to ensure that people are around you, including yourself first, are managing their emotions and thinking clearly and acting in, I wouldn't say like a robot, but sometimes you have to get into that mode where you're just so focused that the heart doesn't speak as much as the mind. Facts. We've all said it. You need to know the facts before you open your mouth on anything. So do your research, ensure that you have factual information and stick to that. And then most importantly, stay true to your values. I think this is a really good example of the COC and CPC living their values. The decision was made for the athletes. It wasn't an easy decision, but it was in the best interest of the athletes, the coaches, the support staff, the health of their families, and obviously global health in general. But this was very much a decision based on values. And sometimes you really need to recheck your values in terms of how you're going to counsel your leadership in terms of what they say and obviously the decisions that they make. This was a group effort. And when you enter a group, you have to respect each other's lanes. And you have to capitalize on people's expertise. And sometimes it's very important that you allow other people to take responsibility of an area. If your job is to draft a press release, you can't neglect the phone ringing with media, because if you do, the media are not going to be pleased with your servicing. So you need to dispatch people to ensure that all aspects are covered. Timing. Sylvie mentioned it, Barb mentioned it. You need to lead, otherwise you're going to be playing catch up and you're not controlling the crisis, you're not controlling the message. And Sylvie mentioned earlier the EPRP, always prepare for worst case scenario. That way you're ready no matter what. And you, if it's not as bad as it is planned for, then you can actually downgrade your reaction to it. But always plan for the worst case scenario. And communicate to your stakeholders. And by doing so, you're actually inputting their feedback and you're shaping the message with them versus trying to tell them what to say. You gotta be flexible. You know, you gotta be ready to turn on a dime. Adjust very quickly. And I end with a quote that was shared with me by a friend that passed on a while ago now, Randy Starkman. He would always tell me, stay calm, do your part, and just carry on, my friend. You'll do good if you stick to these words. And I've always lived by Randy's advice because Randy was actually part of one of the first sport crises that I had to deal with earlier in my career. And I appreciated his feedback, in dealing with that particular situation. So that's some of the lessons that I've actually learned, obviously, through this exercise and wanted to share with everyone. So thank you, Barb.
Thanks so much, Martin. And I'm going to get you to share just briefly. You referenced when we were planning this in Athens and the power of colleagues. So we're going to take just a few minutes to talk about our shared experiences when you're working with one another at multi-sport games. And then we want to leave time for questions. So Martin, just quickly talk about your experience in Athens and how important your colleagues were to you.
I just want to correct. I gave you the wrong date. So this is how bad I am with dates. Athens was in 2004.
Oh, you know what? That was probably me.
No. That's for sure me. Athens was my first Olympic Games. And if you go back to the list of several crises that I've dealt with, there's actually a couple in there that are listed, whether it's riots, whether it's hospitalization, athletes being thrown in jail. That was not an easy games for me, and I didn't come in prepared for that. And what actually allowed me to survive all of this is the people around me. And it's interesting, I'm seeing the list of people on this call, and obviously there are some of you that were with me. Steve Keogh, for example, was a great asset for me based on his, his past experience with Salt Lake, for example. And so I think what I've learned the most from those games is that you don't know it all. And the people around you and the relationships that you build are so incredibly important because they are there to help. They will be there to counsel you and guide you through these crises. In reference to Randy Starkman, even the media will be there to help you if you've built those relationships ahead of time. And so it's incredibly important that you respond to them during a crisis as much as you would respond to them on any day. And even if you're not prepared to respond to the particular crisis, they will respect if you tell them, I'm working on a statement, we're not quite sure the details yet, but please stay tuned, I will call you right away. And I think just by doing that versus ducking the media will reinforce your relationships with them. But in terms of the colleagues, you can draw from knowledge all around you. And I think the most important thing that I've learned in Athens is not to be afraid to say, I don't know what to do. What do you guys think? And that's how I started to learn. And I still do that today. After several decades of crises, I still sometimes don't know what to do. And I will reach out to the people that I have tremendous respect for. And they may even say, I don't know what you should do, but this person might. And so that's Athens for me. It will always be my favorite games because it was the hardest games.
And I'm just going to share really quickly a little bit of the experiences that I had working in Vancouver, where Sylvie was the press chief and I was the media attaché for the figure skating team. And of course, we within a 24-hour sort of period, we were dealing with the unexpected news that Joanie Richette's mom had passed away. And then we also had Tessa and Scott about to win the first gold medal for Canada in ice dance ever. And so we were, we had prepared for a lot of different scenarios, but we had never thought about the possibility of an athlete losing a parent. And so, my advice in that is play to your strengths. It was so awesome, as Martin had said, to have colleagues and to know that I was not alone in all of this by any stretch of the imagination. But Sylvie and I chatted back and forth, I think, a lot that day, as I recall, and when it first happened. And play to your strengths. Sylvie dealt with what the Olympic Committee needed to do, and as a Canadian athlete, and we prepared to make a statement that morning at the COC briefing that was already scheduled. I was so glad that Twitter was in its infancy, and we actually had a few hours to pull ourselves together. And then as it unfolded, and we, again, as Sylvie mentioned, we kept Joanie and her coach, Manon Perron, in a bubble. And we dealt with it from that perspective, and then Sylvie dealt with it from the COC perspective, and allowed us to communicate effectively. And to the best of my knowledge, we had no complaints from the media that they didn't get access, because we got quotes out to them, we got information to them, we kept the information flowing, and we did it back and forth between the COC and Skate Canada to keep all of the different parties organized. I could go on, I could do a whole case study just on that issue, but I just wanted to say that about Vancouver 2010 and how important it was to be a part of a team at that moment.
What was great about that, Barb, is that it says stay in your lane here. And we really, really worked well. I mean, the fact that we know each other and like each other and that relationship already exists, as Martin just said, really helped. There was the trust was already there among us. And so it was basically you and I saying, okay, here's what Skate Canada is doing. and here's what the Canadian Olympic team is doing. And that's when you and I, you know, discussed, we said, we want to get the news out. Media were already talking about it. It got leaked in the middle of the night. And so we knew we had to get out early. And so we used our morning press conference to have the, I believe the president and CEO of Skate Canada there to make a statement. And so right away, you know, it diffused it from a media perspective because we fed the information in a very quick manner. And I remember we did something like I was talking about protecting the athlete who's involved. Mm-hmm. Sylvie Frechette was managing our athlete relations as a member of our team in Vancouver. And so we were asked by many media what, you know, for quotes from the Canadian Olympic team. We actually put Sylvie out there to speak on behalf of the athletes because she was not competing, obviously. And so she wasn't being taken out of her responsibilities and her competition bubble like the others were. And she'd also lived through tragedy, right? So she had obvious empathy and had lived through tragedy in Barcelona in 92. So there were a number of things I remember, like you said, we could make a case study of it, that we identified each group involved, you know, were very, I think it was managed very well. And I think Joanie, you know, as catastrophic as that experience was able to still, obviously winning a bronze medal, right? And still get through those games with the support of the people around her. And I remember, Martin, you were in Whistler and you had, if you want to speak quickly about, you had a death obviously occur in a sliding sport. So that
yes,
was.
Yes, so was I was secluded in Whistler in working with the sliding sports. And obviously we had a rough start with the Georgian luge athlete that got into an accident and later on passed away. And so we had a lot of emotions to manage, so to speak. But one particular example, and you talk about teamwork and play on your strength, is in one evening at bobsleigh, we had a gold medal potential athlete, Melissa Hollingsworth, putting everything on the line and not finishing on the podium. And moments after, John Montgomery won the gold medal for Canada. And I was fortunate to support Chris Dornan, who's very, very known and very respected in the world of sport and media, obviously. And we looked at each other and Chris said, "You take John because that's the, you know, go on and I'll take care of Melissa because I have that relationship with her." And there was no doubt that, you know, that wasn't the right approach. I didn't sleep for 48 hours, but that was fine. But Chris actually dealt with Melissa and was a rock to her. And to this day, she will always talk about that moment in dealing with that, that performance and what came after that. So, you know, when you look at sharing and working with people, I think you need to do what's best for the athlete first. And I think that decision that we made, that was obviously suggested by Chris, was the right one by far.
Rick, I can't see the chat, so I just want to check in with you if we've had any questions that you'd like us to deal with.
Yeah, one has come in, Barb. In the past, we've sometimes seen a rush to defend by organization and their authorities. Can the panelists reflect maybe on one such example and comment on the fine line that separates fact from fiction? And maybe, Sylvie, if you could start, this kind of takes me back to the Ben Johnson scenario, where, you know, there was a rush to defend, and then very quickly afterwards, things started to decline from there.
It was a catastrophic occurrence. I remember vividly being woken up at 4 a.m. to say that Ben had tested positive. And I'm of two minds of this, because what happens is, with hindsight, you actually get the entire story over the last few decades, right? The entire story is that I believe almost the entire final participants, there's 7 out of 8 tested positive, and it was going to be a fiasco in the end of the Olympics as we know it. And so they decided that they were not going to out any of the athletes, but Ben's positive test was leaked. And so with hindsight, with 20, whatever, 30, whatever years it is, you realize that Ben kind of paid the penalty for doping in the sport of athletics, because it was a huge issue and it was wrong and many were doing it. But at the time, what happened is it was so huge and so incredibly damaging to the Canadian team. We were actually, everybody there were asked not to wear Canadian team clothing, because we were being hounded by everyone, whether it was regular people on the street, media, whoever. And so you're there at the Olympic Games as a member of Team Canada and you're being asked to go underground. And so that's how impactful it was. I think that Carol Ann Leatherin was the chef de mission there, and Carol Ann, her first instinct was to help this young man, Ben, who had been completely destroyed by this. And so there's that fine line between helping a young athlete who may be really screwed up and did the wrong thing, but you don't want them to be completely destroyed for the rest of their life, right? So you want to help them through that. And then there's that other side, which is what you did was wrong and you need to pay a penalty. And so I think you have to take both into account and say, I'm going to support the athlete. It's like somebody, you know, gets caught shoplifting, they get chance to get a lawyer and speak to a judge and explain, and maybe they had no money and they have a little baby at home and they stole some baby formula, and maybe, you know, the penalty will be a bit less, you know, even though what they did was wrong. And so it's the same thing with sport, is that you want to help the athlete through the process, but if they, obviously, if they did something that was against the rules and regulations, whatever that may be, then obviously you have to pay the penalty. But you can still help the athlete through that. So if you understand what I mean, there's really two sides to the issue.
And a follow-up to that question, there was a reference to either lead or wait for all info before issuing a statement or a position in this situation. Or are there other principles to follow in helping decide which path to choose?
I think one of the things that we didn't mention that can kind of get you through something is what we call a holding statement. And Sylvie kind of alluded to that. And that is, if you don't know what the situation is at the moment, here's what we do know. We'll get back to you. And then the big thing is whether it's a press conference or if it's one media phone call, you have to get back to them. If you say you're going to get back to people, you really need to. So I think, again, so often these situations are fluid, that you can only tell people as much as you do know. And even though in the background you may know it's the tip of the iceberg, but you until you're sure of everything, you don't want to start getting into speculation and innuendo and blame game or anything like that. So if you really know nothing, just at least get a holding statement out there. I don't know if Sylvie or Martin wants to say anymore.
We call it feeding the beast, and you don't want to refer to our friends in the media as beasts, but really feeding the beast is important. And a good example is Vancouver. Barb, you orchestrated this, but Mike Slipchuk, who was a team leader for the figure skating team in Vancouver, instead in the mix zone after Joanie skated, instead of having Joanie come out because mm-hmm. she wasn't ready after her short program for obvious reasons, he said, I've spoken to Joanie. Here is her statement. Short and sweet. Mm-hmm. And so basically, while Joanie wasn't available, he spoke on her behalf, gave her words to the media, and everybody was happy. So you can always have something to say. And even if you don't know, you say, we don't know yet what happened, but we are talking to these individuals. We will be getting back to you within 1 hour. We figure we'll have the information. So stand by. We're working on it. We'll be right back. Martin, I don't know if you'd like to add anything.
It's exactly what I would suggest.
Well, thanks very much, Barb, Sylvie, and Martin, for an enlightening session. I just wanted to make a comment to Sylvie's point earlier. If you make a mistake, own it and admit it. You know, I learn so much from my mistakes that I try to make one at least one a day, and I've really incorporated that into my professional and personal development strategy. Ask my wife or any of my staff, and really, if you're working in the events business, you really haven't earned your stripes yet until you've managed a crisis, because sure enough, one will occur when you probably least expect it. Just a comment, this webinar, the recording will be available on our website at the link on your screen. And if you're not already following us on our social media platforms, then please do so at Spore Tourism CA, and specifically for our Congress is at events_STC, or on LinkedIn. We've had a tremendous bump on our LinkedIn platform.
Thanks, Rick.
As Sylvie would say, connect there. As far as our next webinar, it'll be a week from today at 1 o'clock Eastern, Esports Insight, also known as The Future So Bright, I've Gotta Wear Shades. And some of you know Vlad Marinescu, who was recently elected as the president of the International Esports Federation, and we're looking forward to that session next week. So thanks once again for participating, and to all of you, and have a wonderful rest of day. Thanks again.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Great to see you.